Well, good afternoon, everyone. We are here for the Tuesday coaching call, and we are going to discuss a few things. We want to welcome all the new San Francisco mentorship buyers that came on board with us, and we look forward to working with you and have a long-standing relationship. If you ever need anything, you know to reach out to Jermaine or myself, and we'll be here to help. I'd like to personally have the privilege of introducing a well-known real estate investor as well as SEC attorney to present to you today, Kim Taylor of Syndication Attorneys. If you have ever wondered how to put together a syndication and the types of documents needed and the costs associated with that, those are the questions to ask Kim. Kim is a very successful SEC attorney, and some of you may have seen her at UP9. Without any more discussion, I'd like to turn the call over to Kim. To ask a question, press *0 on your phone, and the operator will cue you up. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Jeannie.
Well, we're going to see a lot of each other this week.
Yeah. Oh, you're going to be at the Private Money Boot Camp?
Yeah, I'll be there in the back like usual, and you'll be up there in the front.
Yeah. Well, I'm super excited to go. I can't wait.
Well, we're happy to have you on the call today, and I know that everybody's going to get so much out of your discussion, and I'm going to turn the floor over to you.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Hi, everybody. Thanks so much for taking time out of your day and coming on the Dave Teach call. I have taught a number of these in the past. Some of you may have already heard some of my recordings. I'm really excited that I was asked to be on this one. And this one comes just in advance of doing a Private Money Boot Camp. So if any of you have never been to the Private Money Boot Camp, that's definitely something you're going to want to put in your calendar. If you can't make this one, you know, look and see when the next one is. But it's 3 days of training where, you know, I can only train you so much in the hour time that we have here. But if you can get face-to-face, then we can go a lot deeper into this and give you the confidence that you need to be able to go out and raise money profitably, legally, ethically. So anyway, let's just jump right in. I'm going to start on kind of the basics today because some of you might be new and you've never even heard of real estate syndication, you don't know what it is, and so I'd like to just lay it all out for you so that you really understand the foundation of a real estate syndication and what its purpose is and where, what your role in that is going to be. And then I'll talk for a little while, and then we will turn the call over to you to ask whatever questions you might have in follow-up or any other questions you might have about securities laws that I might be able to answer for you. Just to tell you a little bit about myself, I do run a securities law practice, and we cater primarily to real estate investors. There's many other Dave Lindahl students that are clients of ours, and many of them have started out perhaps just like some of you, have never done a syndication before, and some of them have gone on and syndicated, you know, 25, 26 properties, or they're starting to do much larger deals, you know, where we have people who started out buying $3 to $5 million properties and are now buying $25 to $30 million properties. So, you know, we want to help you get to that same level, and that's part of what we do a little differently as a law firm. Instead of just, you know, throwing documents at you, here you go do your own thing. We like to nurture you and help you and give you the education and the foundation that you need to be able to do this sustainably for a long period of time. And so I hope that's what you all want to be able to do. You know, I'm assuming that you've come to the Lindahl organization because you want to learn how to buy commercial real estate, probably multifamily, but there's certainly other commercial asset classes that Dave teaches about that you can explore, and these principles that I'm teaching with you will work with all of them. So let's just get started. What is a real estate syndication? It's really a group of people who are organized for a common purpose or to achieve a common goal. So it's just a group that's put together to achieve a common goal. So that could be a lot of things, and you know that you don't even have to look at it in a real estate context. But so how does that work? You know, the way that we're thinking about it. Well, you're going to be contributing sweat equity. So you're going to Dave's events and you're learning how to acquire specific asset class, and you're applying the principles that you're learning in Dave's class to go out and analyze deals, find deals, and put together, you know, a purchase and sale agreement, you know, send out LOIs and get something under contract. So you're putting all the sweat equity in, and well, then what? So then once you get that property under contract, now you have to organize your team to go out and do all of the due diligence, and then you have to be able to get the financing. So you're going to still be looking for some kind of a bank financing if it's commercial property. Then once you've got that commercial financing kind of lined up, there's going to be a gap between the amount that you're raising from, say, an institutional lender or a bridge lender and the amount that you need to actually acquire that property. And if you're going to be doing some kind of value add proposition on that property, then you're going to need the money to do that as well. Additionally, you might want to be able to pay yourself an acquisition fee, and you want to be reimbursed for all the money that you put out for deposits and due diligence and all of those things. So you're going to need to raise money for that and your closing costs for the property. So all of that, that gap money is what you can raise from private investors. But you're doing all the sweat equity to find the property, do the due diligence, get the financing, and then on top of that, set up the syndicate so that you can go out and you can raise the money from these private investors. So you're, that's your sweat equity. So what do the investors contribute? Well, they contribute money. And if you're setting up a true syndication, you're putting up the money, they're passively, or you're putting up the, all the work, you're putting all the sweat equity into it, they're passively investing. And so that's generally what a real estate syndicate looks like. Who's the person that organizes the group and raises the money? Well, that person is called a syndicator. All right, that could be either one person, or it could be more commonly, it's a group of people, 2 to 4 people, who are delegating these tasks among themselves. Or you can form a company, and usually you're going to form a company if there's more than one individual who's going to serve as that syndicator. Another name for that is going to be the issuer. And we'll talk about why that's important when we get to talking about securities. Another name is a sponsor. It could be called a manager, a promoter, or a general partner. I usually use the term syndicator or issuer because I think that's more in the context of what we're going to be talking about. So in a real estate syndication, the syndicator is really, you know, they're going to go out, they're going to identify the asset. But what that asset has to have some special characteristics. It has to yield a sufficient return to be able to pay the syndicator something for doing all of this work, as well as to pay the investors a reasonable return on their investment. And currently in the marketplace, you know, we're seeing investors that are happy to invest if they can see an 8% preferred return or they can you know, see something that's going to get them maybe 8% during the period of operation of the property, and then at some point when you go to sell, then they like to see that 8% get bumped up because you're going to share some of the equity that's realized on the sale, and then that's going to put them, you know, up into a higher annualized return. So you've got to be able to find properties that can yield that. So I know Dave has his Holy Trinity. And if you haven't heard about that yet, I'm sure you will. But that's kind of, you know, what you need to look at. We are, however, in a changing market. And the changing market is that, you know, we're starting to see, you know, a little tightening of the market. It's a little harder to find the deal. So it may be time that, you know, investors are going to get start to realize that they can't get as high of a returns as they've gotten in the past, or maybe you're not going to be able to keep quite as much of the deal for yourself as you have in the past, just to ride through these, you know, next years or two, and then when things loosen up again, we'll be back to where we were before. So it's still a viable business. It's just, you know, you've really got to dig hard to find those deals that meet that holy trinity, and, you might end up looking at multiple asset classes and some of the other asset classes that Dave teaches, as well as multifamily, while you're setting up your initial syndication. So you've got to have enough return. And when I say return, I'm talking about the cash-on-cash returns. That's the term that Dave teaches. So when you invest a certain amount of money, you're going to look at how much is that money, you know, and this is your investor's money from your syndicate, how much is that money going to yield on an annualized basis during operations and then eventually after the property is sold and the equity is split with investors and divided up amongst the members. So you've got to be able to see that sufficient return in order to be able to do the deal. If it doesn't have a sufficient return, then it's probably not a good deal for syndication. It might be a good deal for you to invest in by yourself, or it might be a good deal for you and, you know, one or two buddies to invest in by yourself, but not necessarily as a syndicate, maybe more as kind of a smaller joint venture or something like that. So what kind of properties do people syndicate? Any existing commercial or multifamily property, you can develop vacant land, you can syndicate single family properties, self-storage facilities, retail shopping centers, office buildings, mobile home parks, mixed use, residential or commercial development projects. So really any kind of real estate can be syndicated. The syndicator is going to go out and get some institutional financing. You're usually going to get institutional financing for somewhere between 65 to 85% of the purchase price. And so then again, we're just funding that gap, the down payment, the closing costs, and then whatever other money you need to make capital improvements or to pay yourself an acquisition fee. Additionally, you can get paid back all the money you put out for your due diligence. So what will a syndicator offer in exchange for their money, for an investor's money? Well, you're typically, if you weren't getting institutional financing, you could offer promissory notes. So if you were doing single family properties, then you might be able to offer promissory notes to your investors, because there's no lender involved who's going to say, hey, you can't have any second subordinate debt. If you're buying commercial properties, very often the lender is going to say that you can't have any personal debt or any subordinate debt on the property behind their loan. They want to know that they're the only financing. They will let you bring in investors, but they won't let you have a subordinate debt, so they won't let you use a promissory note for that gap fund. So you have to get that a different way. So that's why a lot of people go to the syndication process. So what do you call it when you have a syndicate and you're offering it to investors? Well, you would call that a private placement offering or a securities offering. And the private placement is really just a term that's kind of been coined by the SEC and the securities industry that is the disclosure document that explains the risk of investing to the investors. And it puts together the entire package so that the investors can get all of the information they need to make informed consent in order to make their investment decision. So if you're offering promissory notes, okay, then that's one way that you can get money from investors. The other way to get money from investors would be to form a company and sell off interest in that company to investors. So, for instance, if you wanted to have an LLC and you're going to keep a portion of the ownership interest in that LLC for yourself as the syndicator and the one who's doing all that sweat equity, then you're going to sell off the other portion. Let's just, for argument's sake, say that you're going to keep 40% of the company for yourself, and you're going to sell off 60% to investors. Okay, so that LLC has an operating agreement. The operating agreement is something that is, so whenever you form an LLC, first of all, you're doing it under the Limited Liability Company Act of the particular state in which it's being formed. Usually the state that you're going to form it in is going to be where the property is located. Well, that Limited Liability Company Act is going to define how that company has to be run. All of these acts, every state has one, says is if you don't have an operating agreement, then you're going to run it in accordance with this act. It's not necessarily favorable to you to run the company in accordance with the act. So you can supersede that act by having an operating agreement that says, no, this is how we're going to run it. And this is going to be the governing document on the rules of how we're going to run this company. So that's what the operating is. It's the governing document for running your company. So once you have an operating agreement, then you as a syndicator, that's where the term manager comes in. If you're using a limited liability company to sell off interest to your investors, then that LLC is going to have a manager. And the manager or syndicator is going to be the one who's in charge of day-to-day operations of the company and then only involves the investors in certain major decisions involving the company. You could be using a limited partnership instead of an LLC. If you're using a limited partnership, then you would have a general partner in the place of a manager. Okay, so the syndicator would be the general partner, and then you would have limited partners who are investing the cash. In the LLC, you have a manager. The investors are called members. In the limited partnership, you have a general partner. The investors are called limited partners. There's a corollary for this also in corporations, but you're typically not going to use a corporation to invest in real estate unless you're doing a lot of single-family fix and flips, and then you might. But in a corporation, the corollary would be the officers and directors would be the syndicators and the shareholders or stockholders would be the investors. And so if you were doing something other than real estate, then you would possibly use a corporation for that instead of an LLC or a limited partnership. So when you're doing that private placement offering, there's a series of documents. There's a group of documents that the attorney will prepare for you. And they will consist of this private placement memorandum. So again, that's the disclosure document that explains the risks to investors. This is a really important document. And the reason it's so important is because it shifts the risk of loss from the syndicator to the investors. Because if your investors are given all the information they need to make informed consent, which is your obligation if you're selling securities, then they will, once they've been given that information and they've read it, then they are assuming the risk if they invest, knowing that there are ways that their money could be diminished or lost, and that they've taken down that risk and they're going to invest anyway. So the private placement memorandum is one of the documents you would provide to them. That's the main document. This operating agreement we discussed would be attached to it. You would also, when you form your company, you would file a document with the Secretary of State in the state where that LLC or that limited partnership is going to be formed. That document would be attached to the private placement memorandum. So that's either going to be your articles of organization or certificate of formation. It's usually called something like that. It's not articles of incorporation. You would only use that if you were using a corporation. So you've got your private placement memorandum, you've got an operating agreement, you've got your articles of organization or certificate of formation. What else might you have attached to that private placement memorandum? Well, there's another document that is part of your securities offering package, and that's called a subscription agreement. And that's where the investor certifies to you that they meet the qualifications to be in that investment and that they are aware of all the risks. They've read all of the documents. They've read the private placement memorandum. They've asked you all the questions that they have. They've asked questions of their financial advisors, and they are satisfied that this is an appropriate investment for themselves, and they are going to invest, and here's how much. So that's an important document as well. So the PPM is where you're telling them, hey, here's the risks, here's how we're organized, here's what's happening, here's who we are, and here's what we're doing. And the subscription agreement is where the investor is telling you about themselves and saying, yes, I am qualified, I've read the documents, I understand I could lose my money, and I'm going to invest anyway. So that's also another important document. Another thing that has to happen with a securities offering is there's usually some securities notice filings that have to be filed with securities regulators. So this is where people who go out and just, you know, use other people's documents and try to tailor them to themselves get tripped up, because they don't realize that you also have to do these notice filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission and the state securities agencies, letting them know that you're selling securities in their jurisdiction and that you're claiming a specific exemption, and you're going to identify which exemption you're claiming. So those notices are typically required within 15 days of when the investor's money becomes irrevocably contractually committed. So when does that happen? Well, it certainly happens the day you close on the property and you use their money to acquire it, because at that point you wouldn't be able to give their money back if they asked for it. Perhaps if they asked you a week before, you'd find a replacement investor, you'd give them the money back. But if they do it after closing, obviously the money is already expended, they're bound by the terms of the operating agreement, and they're not able to get their money back until that company, you know, achieves its purpose and refunds money to all of its investors at the same time. All right, so that's kind of what your offering package looks like. There's one more thing that you're going to be providing, and that's going to be information about your property. So I know that Dave has a template that allows you to, it's called a property information package or a property package. Sometimes I like to call it an investment summary. It really just summarizes information about the property, demographics, all of your projections for how the property is going to be performing or how you anticipate it will perform over time, and how long you plan to keep the property, what kind of improvements you're planning for it, and what exit strategies you're entertaining. So with that document, we like to have you create that document as a standalone document that is attached to the private placement memorandum, so that you can show that document to your prospective investors prior to having them read 120 pages of legal documents, because that's about how much this PPM operating agreement and subscription agreement take up. It's around 120 pages. So you'll show them that property package. They'll decide whether or not they'd like more information and are interested in investing. At that point, you would show them the rest of the offering package, and then they would go ahead and make the investment by filling out the subscription agreement and sending it back to you. Okay? So what's crowdfunding? Well, you probably all heard the word crowdfunding. Crowdfunding is really just a means to advertise the securities offering. So it's an opportunity for you, if you select an exemption that allows advertising, the securities exemption, certain securities exemptions don't allow advertising, and some of them do allow advertising. So you have to make sure that you select the appropriate exemption, and then we write the offering documents to accommodate the rules of that specific exemption. And then you have to follow the rules of that exemption. So if you choose that, then you would be able to go out and advertise your offering to the general public. It is somewhat restrictive, though, because it's going to restrict you to using higher net worth individuals in your as investors in your offering than you could if you decided not to advertise. Then you would be able to bring in people with some slightly lesser financial qualifications in order to fill your offering. what we find is that a lot of our clients start off choosing a securities exemption that doesn't allow you to advertise, so meaning that you have to have a pre-existing relationship with your investors before you can offer them an investment opportunity. And that will allow you then to bring in your own family, your friends, people you know who are not necessarily accredited. So what is accredited? Well, accredited means someone who has over $1 million net worth as an individual, or, and then that's excluding any equity in their primary residence, or they have over $200,000 a year income if they're single, or $300,000 a year income if they're a married couple. So I call that the 1-2-3 rule, okay? $1 million net worth, $200,000 income if single, $300,000 if a couple. So if you're using the exemption that doesn't allow advertising, that's called Regulation D, Rule 506B, D like boy. That exemption allows you to raise an unlimited amount of money from an unlimited number of accredited investors, so you don't have to count your accredited investors, and up to 35 sophisticated investors. Well, so who's sophisticated? It's someone who has sufficient business investing or educational experience to be able to understand the risks and merits of the offering. So it's generally got to be someone with more than just a job and no real estate training whatsoever. So who might be considered sophisticated? Well, people who are investing with self-directed IRAs, who have attended a lot of the classes that have been put on by their self-directed IRA company. That's why self-directed IRA companies do that, so that their investors can become sophisticated enough to be able to invest in real estate syndicates and other things. So really just somebody who has more than a job. What about people who are students at Dave Lindahl's events? I think that people have been around for a little while and have gone through a number of Dave's courses could probably be considered sophisticated. Another group that's potentially sophisticated are people who attend your real estate investment association meetings in your local community. Those people might also be sophisticated. So you're really looking for people who have more than just a job that can understand and digest this 120 pages of legal documents that they're going to receive and understand the risks and are willing and able to suffer the loss in the event that something went horribly wrong. All right. So the alternative, so that was Regulation D, Rule 506B. Regulation D, Rule 506C, C like cat, is the one that allows crowdfunding. So Regulation D, Rule 506C allows you to raise an unlimited number, unlimited amount of money from an unlimited number of accredited investors, but they have to be verified by a third party. So in 506B, the investors are allowed to self-certify that they meet the qualifications as accredited, but in a 506C, they would have to go through a process whereby either you or a third party has certified that they are accredited by reviewing their financials within the last 90 days prior to the investment. So there's companies that do this for like $69. Yes?
I think that, you know, this is such good information. I bet you the operator is probably inundated with questions. If you want to just do like a mini break and then come back on and do the rest of your... So, operator,
that
do you have
great.
Questions?
So press star zero if you have any questions.
Correct, star zero. And we don't have any questions at the moment.
Oh, so excuse me, Kim. Go right ahead. I thought you'd have a lot by now because I have a question.
Well, go ahead and ask your question.
Well, on the crowdfunding, I heard that you have to verify. So how do you verify? Do you call their financial institute? How do you do that?
Well, so there's three ways they can do it. They can either show you their financial statement. Mm-hmm. They can show you their income you know, their W-2s or something like that, so
yep.
you can see their income or their tax returns.
Yeah.
Or they can provide you with a letter from their CPA, attorney, or financial advisor, somebody with a license that has reviewed their financials or just knows them to be accredited. You know, I mean, somebody who's been doing their taxes year after year for a lot of years could just write this and say, I know they're accredited.
But if you're going to crowdfund,
they can go,
if you're going to crowdfund,
go ahead.
Don't you have to be under somebody else's white paper if you're just an individual?
No.
That's interesting.
No. Meaning, and what do you mean by that? Maybe I'm misunderstanding what you're asking.
Well, a company that has a license and has the ability to crowdfund, if you're just, say, have a property and you want to raise the money for the property, but you want to do it in such a way that you want to blast an email out to everybody you know, that's basically crowdfunding.
So there's two different things that the SEC calls crowdfunding. Crowdfunding arose underneath the Jobs Act, and it first became legal in September of 2013. And that's when this Reg D Rule 506C was first enacted and became effective. So that was the one that said, hey, if the people are accredited, anybody can advertise to everybody as long as they only make sure that accredited people invest in their offering. So there's no requirement that somebody has to have a license in order to be able to advertise your offering, or you don't have to have a license to be able to advertise your offering. There's another thing under the Jobs Act called Regulation Crowdfunding, otherwise it's sometimes abbreviated as Regulation CF. And that was something that the SEC created that says that you can raise up to $1 million a year from anybody with any financial qualifications and no financial qualifications whatsoever, as long as you only take $2,000 or less from them.
Yeah.
But you're restricted to $1 million in a year. You're restricted to $1 million. You can only take $2,000 from any person, so you're going to have a huge number of investors. And that one can only be sold through what's called a crowdfunding portal, and that portal has to be licensed with the SEC. So that one is very restrictive. Nobody wants to do that for real estate. It really doesn't make sense. And unfortunately, when they created it, they didn't even make it work for single family investors, because they said it couldn't be a blind pool. It had to be for a specific project. So that's really good for someone who wants to open a business, or, you know, or get some seed capital to develop a product, or, you know, open a restaurant or something like that, and it's just a one-time thing. But for real estate investors, that doesn't work very well, and that's why everybody ends up using that Regulation D, and they either choose the 506B if they want to be able to bring in money from family and friends, or they use the 506C if they want to advertise. Does that make sense?
Right. Yep, makes sense to me.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Do we have any questions by now?
Yes, we do. We actually have two questions at the moment. The first one comes from Herman. Herman, please go ahead.
Hi, Herman.
Hello, Kim. My name is Herman. I have a question. Early on, you mentioned having an 8% preferred return for offering to the investors. Can you define preferred return as opposed to any other kind of return?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, Simon. So a preferred return really just means that you're going to pay investors first before you take your cut. So whatever cash that you get from cash flow during operation of the property, we have this term we call distributable cash. And distributable cash is the cash that's left over after you've paid all of the operating expenses of the property, you've paid off your debt service, and you've withheld sufficient working capital and reserves for whatever you have planned for the property and your, you know, some upcoming bills. Then anything above that we call distributable cash. so whenever you want to make a distribution to your investors, which you're usually going to do on a quarterly basis, we never recommend that you do it monthly. So when you do that on a quarterly basis, then you would look at how much distributable cash there is and say, okay, we're going to make a distribution of $100. And that $100 is going to be given to our investors. Well, you might have sold off 60% of the interest in that company to your investors and kept 40% for yourself. But you're not just going to split that and give $6 or $60 to investors and $40 to yourself, because you've offered them a preferred return that says you're going to give them 8%. So that means you'd give them all of that money until they had achieved that 8% annualized return. Now, we do this on a quarterly basis, so really it just means you're going to give them 2% per quarter based on their money if you were offering them an 8% preferred return. So at the end of the year, they'd have 8. And then if you only made 8, then they would get it all. What if you only? What if you made 10? Well, if the property yielded a 10% return, then you would have given them 8, and then you probably would have gotten the other 2, because you're still going to be entitled to take something for yourself. What if you only had 6% preferred return for the year? Well, a preferred return can be cumulative, and that's usually how it's done, or it can be non-cumulative. In a cumulative preferred return, you would offer you would carry forward any deficiencies and make it up later on. So maybe they got 6 this year, but they got all the cash. You didn't take any. Okay. Next year, the property yields 8, so they get their 8, but they're still deficient for the first year, so you just keep carrying that forward. You still didn't get anything. The third year, the property yields 10%, so you have a choice. You know, depending on what your offering documents and your operating agreement says, you may be able to, you may have to use that 2%, the excess in the third year, to pay them back their 2 from the first year, or if the offering documents allow it, then you may be able to continue to carry that forward until you sell the property or refinance it, and then you can take your cut in the third year.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. That's really helpful.
Good. Very good. We have another question?
Yes. Up next, we have Dermot. Dermot, please go ahead.
Hi, Dermot.
Hi. Good afternoon. This is Pramod Singh, calling in from Chicago. I have actually two questions. The first question is regarding this SEC. So one thing is that when I'm approaching the investors, there should not be any general solicitation. That means I need to have a prior relationship with them, right? And how do I you know, make that relationship? I mean, is there a way to you know, connect to those investors, prior to, you know, discussing about the deal? And the second question is, let's say I am able to raise the capital for, the down payment when I'm acquiring a property, giving them a promissory note of preferred rate of return of around 16% or 20%, and selling this property in next 3 to 5 years, right? And just in case, if I'm not able to sell the property in 5 years and I can do a refinance, and one of the investors wants to get out of the deal, right? How can I just get him out of the deal? So in that case, whether I have to, even if I'm not, you know, able to sell the property, how would the equity split would work for that particular investors?
Okay, so the first question was how do you establish a pre-existing relationship? Okay,
right.
So if you're doing that Regulation D Rule 506B, that was the exemption that allowed you to raise an unlimited amount of money from an unlimited number of accredited and up to 35 sophisticated investors, but you can't use any form of general advertising or solicitation. And to prove that, you must have a pre-existing relationship with the investor before you even make them an offer to invest. So if you're doing 506B, then you do need to have a process established so that you can prove that you had that pre-existing relationship. And the pre-existing relationship usually has to predate when you had a current or contemplated offering. So that means that you have to be meeting people before you have a property under contract, or if you're meeting people after you have the property under contract, then you may not be able to allow them into that deal. You might have, you're always looking for a future deal. For whoever you're meeting today, you're in looking at them as a potential investor in a future deal, not necessarily the deal you're raising money for right now. So your job, mm-hmm. before you have deals under contract, is to go out and meet as many potential investors as you can and to develop a database of people that you've met and describe how you met them and then follow up with them, because your initial meeting isn't really going to be the place where you're going to be discussing, you know, your business and potential future investment opportunities. And you really should be gathering contact information at the initial meeting, following up in a one-on-one call or meeting, and getting to know each other. So I liken it to a dating process. And you're really just learning at the second meeting whether or not you have some common interests and you want to continue the relationship moving forward. And then at that meeting, you should be finding out about their investment goals and making sure that their investment goals are compatible with the types of deals that you might have to offer in the future. So you, then you're going to go home, you're going to keep notes of what was discussed at that meeting, and then you should have a way to keep in contact with them beyond that. So how could that happen? Well, you might send them some information, you might send them some articles, you might send them a white paper you've written. You might invite them to a further, an investment meeting or something where you could just talk to them, or you might go play golf, you know, or you just might call them on the phone and say, you know, hey, how are you doing? I just wanted to see if you had any questions and follow up from our last meeting, and you just want to keep in touch. So there's no hard and fast rule on how to establish a pre-existing relationship. It's more about the quality of the relationship than how long you've known somebody. The quality is defined as actually knowing enough about the person to understand whether they are sophisticated or accredited before you actually make an offer. So I hope that answers your first question. Your second question, you talked about offering investors promissory notes with 16 to 20% returns. First of all, if you were my client, I would tell you you absolutely should never, ever, ever do that. There's a lot of reasons that you should never ever do that. But the first and foremost is thanks to Bernie Madoff, the SEC and all securities regulators believe that anything greater than a 12% return must be a Ponzi scheme. So you're going to attract some negative attention of the regulators if they get wind that you're offering something like that. Second of all, it's probably not something that's sustainable. The problem with a promissory note versus investing in a company and offering somebody a preferred return is when you offer somebody a promissory note, you've created an adversarial legal relationship. You as the borrower, them as the lender. The lender in the promissory note usually has some enforcement remedy if you don't pay as agreed. And that means that they can come and take something from you. And they're either going to take the property or other collateral property you may have put up in exchange for that note, or you're going to have a personal guarantee and they're going to be able to come after your other personal assets. So that's a pretty harsh legal remedy for an uncertain real estate market, whereas, and then the third reason you're probably not going to use a promissory note is if you're buying multifamily properties and you're getting institutional loans on them, the lenders are going to have a prohibition and they're going to tell you that they're not going to allow you to have other people in second or third position on that property. They will allow you, however, to form a company and sell off part of your company to investors. And so a more realistic thing to do would be to offer them an 8% preferred return plus a share of the profits that are realized on sale, and you know, show them projections that those profits, if the you know the property is sold at the price that you anticipate, you know, 5 years down the road, that those that bump in profits that they would get would kick them up into the return range of where you wanted them to be in that high teen, low 20s range.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. But so just one quick thing. So I understand that. So when you are, you know, forming a company and you are telling them that, you know, in 5 years they will get the percentage of the equity. But what if I'm not able to sell the property after 5 years and I want to keep that? But I have to return the investment.
Yeah, so you'd have to have some kind of an exit strategy that would allow you to refinance that property, give them back their capital, and then you could offer them up to a certain, it's called a hurdle rate. So you would say, once you've achieved this, all your money back plus this annualized return for the entire period of time that I've had your money, then you'll be disassociated from the company and I will continue to own the property without you. I will tell you that that is probably a short-sighted investment strategy. I have had clients that have tried to do that, and their investors did not like it. And they were reluctant to invest with them in future deals because their perception was that we put up all the money, and you get this big windfall at the end, and all we get is this. And they didn't like
right.
it. So you'd be better off to give back their money and maybe, you know, change the terms so that, you know, maybe it flips. Maybe now you get 60% of the returns and they get 40% of the returns or something like that, but they're still in the deal.
Got it. Thank you so much.
Okay. You're welcome. Do we have any other questions?
Yes, we actually have one more. We have Paul. Paul, please go ahead.
Hi, Paul.
Hi, Kim. So the question of the day is, you have an investor that wants to do a 1031, and you have another investor that wants to do a 1031. Is there a way those two investors could team up and buy a bigger property and roll their money, or is that impossible?
There is, but there's not a whole lot in it for you. Because they are going to have to become tenants in common on the property, and they will get a return on their investment. The profits are going to get split according to their percentage interest in the property, and then they could offer to pay you maybe some kind of an asset management fee, but it's hard for you to keep a carve out for yourself. So usually how that would work is you would have to get the property under contract, and then you would sell it to them for a higher price, and the difference between what you were paying and what they were paying would be your portion of that deal. You would need to leave that portion in the deal, and then you would get a return on that investment the same as they do.
Okay, so if if I personally wanted to do a 1031 with my friend, and he's doing a 10, so he sold the property, I sold the property, we both wanted to partner up and buy an apartment complex that is bigger, there is a way to do that. And we could both roll the money with our 1031.
Yeah, the two of you can just do a tenant in common agreement. It's just, it's not the same as a syndicate because you're not going to be keeping, you know, money for doing sweat equity, or you're not going to be keeping a portion of the company for doing sweat equity. It's all going to be based on the amount of money that you rolled in with your 1031.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, you're welcome. Do we have any other callers?
We have no further questions at the moment.
Great. So, Jeannie, should we go a little further or wrap up? Well, we'll just keep going for a little bit longer because the next thing I wanted to cover is, I think, something that you'll all want to know, and that is, why would you syndicate? Right? Why would you do this? Well, the reason is because it leverages your ability to do many more deals and much bigger deals than you personally have money to do by yourself. And that allows you to generate a much greater return for yourself as well as helping out your investors. So, you know, you all have family and friends. If you're like me, who you would
Hi,
like
Kim.
To be able to help
I'm
out.
I'm here.
Hey,
sorry
hey,
about
Jeannie.
That.
That's
Did
okay.
Did you need me for something?
I was just going to say, did you want me to wrap up or go for a little longer?
Sure. If you don't have any more questions, you can wrap it up anytime. I just ask one more time. Operator, is there any questions in the queue?
We have no further questions at the moment.
Okay.
All right. Well, I'm
going to
go ahead and just finish
up.
What I was talking about. Yeah.
Okay.
So
thank you, Kim, for
I
doing
think...
the call. I appreciate you. And I'll see everybody
thank
on the call
you.
Next Tuesday.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
All right. So just to wrap up, why would you syndicate? You know, because you can make a lot of money doing it. And you can help out your family and friends. And it's a good thing to do. And if you don't, you know, it's a great way to make a living. So I thank you all for being on the call today and for listening to me. And I hope it wasn't boring and it was informative. And, you know, I hope that some of you will be coming to the Private Money Boot Camp in Long Beach starting on Friday. And, you know, there may still be time to get in if you haven't done it yet. These are only, you know, they only happen a couple times a year, so you need to get in it now if you want to really just hit the ground running in 2018. But my contact information, if any of you want to contact me, is kim@syndicationattorneys.com. Our website is syndicationattorneys.com. And if you are interested, we do offer free 30-minute consultations. If you go to the website, there's a button you can click to schedule one, and we'd be happy to talk to you if you have any further questions. Otherwise, we look forward to meeting you at the Private Money Bootcamp. Oh, and I did want to mention that there are a lot of articles on our website. There's articles, there's podcasts. We do a free monthly teleconference ourselves, so you know that can just help augment what you're learning from Dave. And you know, I'm glad you're all here, and I'm glad you're all in the right place. And I hope to meet you all at a future event. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Kim. We appreciate you. Take care.
Thank
See you.
You
this weekend.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.